saying? Bill Clinton did what R. Kelly did can with black women. Cedric, talk about him. I'm not sure what the point is there, but Prince Akbar, I feel your pain. We love your energy, brother. I have to defend Wyclef on the dollar. I see your other points. I'm not sure what the R. Kelly, Bill Clinton analogy is, but I think you're trying to say R. Kelly is one of the, you do say R. Kelly is one of the black male celebrities who has been lynched. Okay, Prince Akbar, strong as ever after an 8-month hiatus. Oh man, Kenosha Farrell from Clinton, Mississippi. So Cedric, it has been a while since I had the chance to listen to you live. Another excellent show. I can't wait to get your book. Peace. Thank you. Kenosha. We Kenosha and I became Facebook friends. Like, we ended the on-air friendship. A lot of you all are no longer my real friends. You send me stuff only through Facebook. That's fine. Let me put some Charlie Parker on. Let me smoke out. Rod Guignol, what do you think about this, brother? I'm going to give you some Magic Johnson on top of a bed from Charlie Parker. Is Magic Johnson, what's his, okay, let me say this right. I don't want to cause no problems. I don't want to be misunderstood. Doesn't it seem to you all like Magic Johnson loves Larry Bird more than Larry Bird loves Magic Johnson? This is Seducation. I got to give you Magic Johnson talking about his relationship with Larry Bird on top of a bed. This is Round Midnight from Charlie Parker.
In 1979, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird both entered the NBA, and the league would never be the same. A few years after their arrival, one NBA executive said, quote, "They were East Coast versus West Coast, Lunch Bucket Brigade versus Showtime, the gritty leader versus the flashy star. It was as if they came out of central casting. We couldn't have asked for anything better," end quote. While their personalities provided a polarity, it was their similarities that made them great. A sharp focus, commitment, and drive that to this day separates Magic and Bird from so many professional athletes. With the anniversary of their first NBA matchup coming this month, Magic Johnson and...
Hold on. Dawn Jones has replied. She says, "One can never serve two masters, Mr. Muhammad, formula or not. Simply sign your name. Anything else you'd like to add?" And she has, boom, there. Just Dawn Jones, I'm trembling. You have me, I'm affected by you the same way I was affected by Paul Williams getting beat up Saturday night. I'm nervous. Dawn Jones says she does not care about my radio show formula. She don't care whether I'm using polemics or dialectics. She says, "One can never serve two masters, Mr. Muhammad, formula or not." Magic Johnson, please continue.
Larry Bird tell the story, their story, in a new book written with Jackie McMullen entitled When the Game Was Ours. Joining DA and I to discuss the impact the two players had on the game, Hall of Famer and current Celtic great. I said current Celtic great. I still wish you were dressed in the green, man. Kevin McHale, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
All right, and from this New is from York, another Hall of Famer.
This is from an excellent show on NBA TV called The Beat.
Magic Johnson. Magic, thanks for taking the time, and congrats.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, I want to dive right into this, Magic. You know, in the book, Michael Thompson recalls joining the Lakers, and in his first game against the Celtics, he's in the locker room, and it's dead quiet, and he's really nervous, and he asks Byron Scott what's going on, and Byron just turns to him and says, "We hate the Celtics." Can you describe what that vitriol was like?
Well, I tell you, he was right. We did hate the Celtics. Even Kevin is sitting there right now. But we hated them because they were so good. And we knew that they could beat us. When you got the best, you're playing against the best front line in basketball history, and Kevin, Larry, and Robert Parrish, you knew you were in for a long night every time you played the Celtics. But the rivalry was special. And I think, and Kevin, you could probably add to this, that's what's missing today. We need those rivalries back. We have the superstars, no question about it, and Kobe and LeBron and Dwayne Wade. I mean, we can go on and on and on. I love where our game is, but I want to see some of these rivalries, and maybe we'll get a chance to see that this playoff season when some of these teams have to hook up again. And so that's when basketball was special, because we knew at the end of the day we were going to play the Celtics, a team that disliked us and we disliked them, and that you had so many subplots. You had Magic versus Bird. You had Kevin versus James Worthy. You had Kareem versus Parrish. I mean, all these things within a game were happening, and the fans were treated to some of the, well, I think the best basketball they've ever seen. Teams that could play defense, run, shoot from the outside, and play the game the right way.
I agree. You know, Magic, the thing that made such a big impact on us was we knew we could play good and still lose. And that we didn't like that feeling, because normally if we played good, we could beat everybody. We knew if we played you guys and played good, we could still lose. So that became the rivalry, because then we said, okay, we got to do all the little things. Hey, we got to muck this game up. We got to hold, grab, we got to hit. I had to grab Worthy's goggles and knock him off his face. And you got to do all these things to try to, you know, get you guys off your game, because that was the respect we had. But you're right. No one liked each other, but there was a deep respect, because we knew that both teams could flat out just play basketball. And I always say, you take those teams today, throw them in the NBA right now, they can flat out play basketball.
Oh, no question about it. You just said it right.
Hey, Kevin, you know, Magic talked about it, and it gets kind of not mentioned in the rivalry. Your rivalry with James Worthy and the great battles that you had with Worthy. Can you just talk about how you approached guarding him and what you wanted to do with him when you had the ball at the other end?
Well, I was hoping he was guarding me, but they used to put the bigger guy on me. I just would run down there. If I had him, I'd be yelling, throw me the ball before they switch. But the problem was that he was guarding Larry. And this is, you know, one time Larry shoots a jump shot, and he's trashing the offensive glass. I look up, and James has got like a 20-foot head start on me. I looked at Larry and said, look, I can't catch him when we stake off on a dead straight. You can't be giving this guy a 20-foot head start on me. I said, you got to stay with him. Larry looked at me and goes, hey, if I stay with him, Kevin, I may have to guard him on the other end. I said, oh, no. So I had a heck of a time guarding James Worthy. He was so good. What I had one chance. I couldn't give him layups and dunks. If he got layups and dunks early in the game, he got on fire. I had to sprint back. I didn't go to the offensive glass the first 5-6 possessions. I ran back and made sure he didn't get any layups and dunks. And then he had to play over my length in the half court, which at least gave me a fighting chance.
Hey, Magic, he talks about that relationship. The relationship with you and Larry, I know it changed dramatically after a meeting that you had shooting a commercial in Indiana. Can you tell us a little bit about what that meeting was like and how that did change the relationship?
Well, you know, it was kind of tough. He was the year before, he was the MVP, and I had won it that season. And so Converse called and said, hey, look, we want to shoot a commercial talking about you being the MVP. And I said, okay, cool. So I'm thinking, Kevin, it's going to be in Los Angeles. So he goes on, you know, he pumping me up. Oh, yeah, your MVP is great. So I said, okay, L.A., where are we going to shoot it? And he said, well, we were thinking about shooting in French Lick, Indiana. I said, huh? Wait a minute. You mean I got to go to French Lick, Indiana? I'm the MVP, and I got to go to Larry's hometown? He said, yep. I said, oh, man, okay. So a black man in French Lick, Indiana, okay. One street light in the middle of the town. And so I gave in finally. I said, okay, I'm going to go, you know. So we're pulling up, and I get out of the car. And normally when there's a commercial shoot, you know, both guys embrace each other. We came up and hey. You know, it wasn't a hug, it wasn't eye contact, it wasn't anything. So I said, oh boy, it's gonna be a long day shooting this commercial. So I went to the trailer, I came back. So the director has Larry on one side, me on another side, and he's telling us what he wants to do. So I said, okay, and Larry said, okay. But we really never talked. So we went about our business for the next 3 or 4 hours. So now we got a lunch break. And so as I don't know if you guys can imagine this, Larry built this incredible, he had about 20 acres or so. It's incredible. And the basketball court was at least a mile from the house, or 2 miles from the house, right? So you actually couldn't walk to get there. So we had these Humvees, and we jumped on these Humvees, and we go up to the house, okay? So when we got to the door, God bless her, his mom was standing there, and she gave me the biggest hug, and she made me just melt, you know? And I said, oh, wow, Larry, you got the best mom. And right at that moment, you guys, we started talking, and we found out we were similar. And we, you know, two kids from the Midwest, grew up poor, had to work for everything they got, on and on and on. And when we got back, Kevin, for the commercial shoot, we were like two little girls just talking, giggling. Hey, you know, we act like we knew each other for 20 years. And the director couldn't stop us from talking. And so that was the beginning. And Kevin said something very interesting early on. We've always respected the Celtics, and I respected Larry to the utmost because I just really looked at myself when I saw him. And I really wanted to know him. I'm sure he wanted to really know me in a sense as well. And that gave us that moment to know each other as two men, not Larry the basketball right. player, not Magic the basketball player, but as just two men talking. And that started not a friendship yet. It started us to say, okay, that guy is okay. And he could say, hey, that guy is okay. And we right. still would just shake hands and look mean at each other because we had to do that. But D.A., the story is, when I got back to L.A. and the guys heard that I went to French Lick, oh, man. Man, I couldn't. They hit me with, oh, you like the Celtics now. Oh, you won't take him out if he got a layup.
You all are vicious with your comments.
Okay, now you going to wear green next to our practice? You know, on and on and on, man. They harassed me for a whole month about going to French Lick. So I didn't take too kindly to them harassing me for a month.
Hey, Magic, it's just one of the great stories. And, we appreciate you taking some time and sharing it with us. And certainly best of luck to you as well with the book. And, hey, we'll keep it.
Let me show you all how I get down the show. A few comments on R. Kelly I want to read. The OG of this show is Rod Guinea, Culver City, California. I got an article here. This is Seducation, hour number 5. I just play music and read stimulating articles. But I think my wig is froze. My dome is froze from Steven Silberger and Wyclef Jean. So I'm a little scattered. But I do certain things for certain commentators because they are so involved and they add so much to the show. As Dawn from Brooklyn can now attest, I have shut down the R. Kelly playing for today. Maybe forever. I'm going to sign Dawn's book, put it in the mail. But what I'm interested in seeing is how the marketplace determines when they've had enough of a certain individual. Meaning, did the R. Kelly fatigue result from black pressure from the ground up? Or did it result from corporate and media propaganda or coverage that made black people form that opinion? Meaning, oh man, I don't want to get too deep into this, but I'm trying to make a point, which Dawn is helping me make. Now, many of us saw the DVD or the tape back in 2001, as far as R. Kelly is concerned, right? But he went on to have tremendous commercial success. Now, there was something that triggered media coverage in Chicago, very saturated media coverage that coincided with R. Kelly's career going down about, I think, 2 years ago, if I'm correct. Now, my point is this. Is R. Kelly no longer hot because the community said so, or was it because the media, which is half community and half not, formed or shaped public opinion about R. Kelly? So I guess what I'm saying is, does the community really have power to shut down anything it doesn't like? Like, for instance, I got to put the camera on me so you all will see I'm not lying through these sunglasses. Don Imus. Woo. Perfect example. I said it then, I will maintain it now. Don Imus was not shut down by black people. Don Imus was shut down by the Rutgers Mafia, which I am a part of. If Don Imus had said what he said about black women who played for a basketball team in Tennessee, the team that Rutgers played, or virtually any other power center, he would still have his job. You know, anyone that knows the juice of the Philly Rutgers corridor that runs through Jersey, you have New York money, conscious black people, a State University alumni network, and the Philadelphia and New York media and Wall Street all coalescing. That's why Don Imus got fired. He did not get fired because of any grassroots movement by black people. Please stop that. Reverend Sharpton is the man. I love Reverend Sharpton. He named me the godfather of cyberspace, but it was not because of Reverend Sharpton and black people. So here's my point with R. Kelly. What made R. Kelly passe or radioactive? Was it really black community standards, moral standards, or ethics? Or was it just the media cooperating with record labels not being able to make as much money off of him? You feel me? All right, let me put the show logo back up. Listen to this right here. Okay. But anyway, let me do something for Rod Guignard before I read these R. Kelly comments and more about the Wyclef Jean interview and Steven Silberger. I feel the need to confirm my jazz bona fides or bona fides with Rod. We have a thing where we go back and forth. I only learned jazz. My musical taste comes from my father. Okay, so whatever my father played is what I still love to this day. So there's a few gaps in my my music. My musical knowledge is not encyclopedic. Feel me? I'm coming for you, Rod. What you know about this? Financial Times article: Return to Bass. After a 35-year gap, jazz bassist Henry Grimes was reunited with the instrument he loves. Let me give you a little taste of this right here. How gangster am I? Scroll down a discography of the great jazz bass player Henry Grimes, and you come across something quite singular. A major league recording career that starts in 1957 and revolutionized jazz bass stops suddenly on December 18th, 1966, before resuming in 2003. His return to music after 35 years was down to Marshall Mera, an American jazz fanatic. Realizing that no one knew the answer to the "whatever happened to Henry Grimes" question, he did some detective work and eventually found him living in a single room in Los Angeles. Grimes hadn't even owned an instrument since 1970 and was getting by on unskilled manual jobs, channeling his creative energy into poetry. Once people found out what had happened to Grimes, everything changed, and quickly. A fellow bass player lent him an instrument. A fiendish practice routine was undertaken, and within weeks, Grimes was recording and performing again. Since his return to New York for the 2003 Vision Festival, he has made more than 50 recordings and broadcasts and has performed 350 gigs in 23 countries. Collaborators range from the iconoclastic pianist Cecil Taylor to new generation heavyweights such as saxophonist David Murray and guitarist Mark Ribot. R-I-B-O-T. This is Henry Grimes and Rashid Ali. Let me give you a Henry Grimes solo if I can find it. Rod Guignard, eat your heart out, brother. This is how I get down during hour number 5, Seducation. I want to read an article about U2's manager, but let me get your comments in. Yeah, you all are killing Magic Johnson for what you heard. And Rod Guignard says he wants me to tell him who wrote Round Midnight. I need help. I don't know. I give up. Janine, the queen from Hartford, Connecticut, she says, yes, said, thank you for making that point on Magic. Stop it, Magic. Yes, Bird was great, but why throw Isaiah under the bus? Oh, yeah, money. Janine, spitting it raw. She says, stop it, Magic. The best front line of all time? No. The refs let the Celtics travel like crazy. Now, I don't want to open up any old wounds, but Robert Parrish did used to take a high-speed train through that three-second lane. Oh, they used to let Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish travel, man. I'm in love with Janine. Who else would know that? Magic Johnson said the greatest front line of all time is the Celtics. Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish. But Janine points out the refs let them travel. Janine, who is the best front line in your opinion of all time? Rod Guignard says, God bless Brother Magic, but he needs to spend a minuscule piece of his money on the same elocution lessons that OJ got when he was at USC. And to think he and his producers thought that the public loved Magic so as to endure that travesty that was his talk show. Oh, yeah, I remember the Magic Johnson show. Remember that? How long did that Magic Johnson show last? Like 3 months? Rod says, Magic is a good brother nonetheless. And yes, that relationship with Bird is a bit questionable. Speaking of friendships, did you know that Joe Frazier and Ken Norton never fought one another? Right in the midst of them both being heavyweight contenders or champions, they were the best of friends and refused to fight each other. Got to be a first. Oh, by the way, I think that just my feeling, I believe that Floyd Mayweather Jr. is going to help Manny Pacquiao campaign for political office after the fight. Just a strong feeling I have. Anyone else thought about that? Aaron Pryor helped Alexis Arguello campaign for public office after he beat the crap out of him. I believe that after Manny Pacquiao was beat down by Floyd Mayweather, that Money May will fly to Manila, wherever Pacquiao's from, in the Philippines, and he will help get him elected. Manny Pacquiao was running for some high office. Prince Akbar from The Shy, he says, thanks for the Wyclef interview and the interview with the Jewish author. I learned a lot, and I hope your guest was not offended. Believe it or not, the only business mentor lever who helped me on a one-to-one basis was Jewish. My first time riding in a BMW was his driving me 2 hours to Milwaukee to ask my family to finance a business I was starting. He worked with me for 2 years. Compare him to my rich aunt, who has never spent 5 minutes with me to teach me her secrets in business. Andy from Largo, Maryland. Oh, this is Henry Grimes. It's how I get down on my show. Andy says, I have deliberately avoided R. Kelly for several years, that he could refer to himself as the Pied Piper while being accused of molesting young black women makes me uncomfortable. For those that don't know, the Pied Piper's story concludes with the Piper using his music to lead all of a town's children away, never to be seen again. I don't know for sure whether this is an unfortunate coincidence or a sick joke, but with so much music available and easily accessible, I haven't lost anything by avoiding R. Kelly's songs. And Rod Ginyar picked up the comment. What did Magic mean by saying two little girls in reference to him and Larry Bizard? Yes, Jeff. Uh-oh. Dawn from, don't get me in no trouble with Dawn from Brooklyn, Jeff. Jeff from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, who is my man. It's my brother. He says, peace, Brother Cedric. I will defend your use of dialectics. I have 5 daughters and strongly oppose the abuse of the female. In order to meet those who are insensitive to the plight of the female, you must engage them in this time period where passive and active abuse of the female is tolerated. Engage the two extremes and produce gradual change in ideology until we stand on the principle that no nation can rise no higher than its woman. Woo. Jeff. Now, Dawn, I have to say something. I would not have known you were there unless I had made the R. Kelly comment, which was not support. I was just playing his music to smoke you all out to see what the position was on R. Kelly. So Jeff has a point. Jeff continues. He says, toy manufacturers who begin the sexualization of females at an early age must be challenged. R. Kelly himself is a victim of a culture that is against women. When you closely listen to some of his music, though, he celebrates the beauty of the woman, but this culture is one that only promotes the body. Honest dialogue on both extremes must be examined. Now, see, I'm going to have to pull out the 1962 Muhammad Speaks article, April 1962. What is the difference between beauty and fashion, or are beauty and fashion the same? I'm going to have to read that one day for Dawn. Dawn says, thank you. Jeff, I had to shut you down. No more. I don't want no more problems with Dawn from Brooklyn. E from Queens. And the rumor is that E from Queens hasn't been seen in Queens lately, but it's a subject for another day. But our beloved E from Queens, he says, I like R. Kelly's music. I think he is one of, if not the best R&B artist of his generation. I think he needs to stop messing with those young girls, allegedly, and drop a new album. Well, the new album is here, E. It's Untitled. And I played 3 songs, and if you didn't hear it, it's over, because Dawn from Brooklyn has shut it down. No more R. Kelly. But here's what Dawn wanted to add. Maybe we can get a Brooklyn Q Burrow beef started here. Dawn says, R. Kelly is hot because he is a musical genius, plain and simple. He shouldn't be supported because he sleeps with children. Yes, it was black people that helped to shut Imus down, but not as a unified block. As black individuals that put pressure on as members of the Rutgers Mafia and personalities Oprah, Sharpton, and the quiet chatter that was stirring the community. Yes, it was a collective effort, but it was not black-led. I'm trying to make a point about community-based activism. Here's my point. Do you all ever see Chinese Americans protesting? No. They will shut you down by not running that Chinatown bus route. That's how they get you back. Sanctions. See, that's the thing. When you have institution building, social cohesion, and independence, you impose economic sanctions on everybody that doesn't do what you want. You don't protest. That was partly my point with Steven Silbiger, which is that he is right. I don't believe that black people can blame Jewish people for forcing them to accept a certain role or sing a certain song, because I was there. You can't tell me that. I know what very conscious rappers did with Jewish financial backing, but not without a Jewish gun at their head. So you can't run that by me. But the argument is, if the Jewish community knew what had worked for them, why didn't they prescribe it for other people? And that's where Stephen and I think had a good exchange about the inward nature of the Jewish religion, which is not evangelical. You all are going to have to run that tape back of Stephen and I having that dialogue, because I think it was very important. I think that there is a level of ignorance that Jewish people take advantage of where black people are concerned. And I think there's a victim beneficiary role that blacks assume, not just by Jewish people, but also by whites. Ow, my knee hurts. Pay me. You know what I'm talking about. The Allen Houston approach to getting paid. So I don't think either side can be left off the hook. So that's why I read what Russell Simmons told me about his relationship with the Syrian Jewish community. Okay, let me read this article about U2's manager, Paul McGinnis. You all up on Paul McGinnis? Play some U2 music up in here. Yeah, Rock Guignard says we must keep Dawn around. I agree. Here's an article on the FT this weekend. Rock and Roll Czar. And again, the Financial Times is the peach paper. I highly recommend it. That and the Wall Street Journal is what I read. For other news, you can go to blackelectric.com. Now, let me say something about my book. We have launched the 3 for $30 deal. Some of you holdouts, you can get all 3 volumes of my book for $30 if you order it through theesecret.com. That's our website, theesecret.com, www.theesecret.com. The orders are pouring in now. 3 for $30, that's the deal some of you have been waiting on. Now, as for me signing the books, we're not doing that now, but we may come out with a hard edition that we can sign. Okay? If you bully me like Dawn with consciousness pricking truth, then I send the book for free, handle all shipping costs, and I inscribe the book. Rod Guignard from Culver City, California says that Jeff from Winston-Salem is awesome. Please don't let this brother go without more from him. You just got the highest honor in the history of the show, Jeff from Winston-Salem. Rod Guignard, the OG of the program, salutes you. Let me read this article on U2's manager. They got a lot of fluff in here. I got to skip a lot. It says here, McGinnis, who was managing a now forgotten. You know what? I may not read this article because it's an article written in such a. You know what? I'm not reading this. I'm going to show you all the article. Let me put the camera up. I just decided I'm not reading this. It does not fit my flow. I had to read a lot of fluff. But let me show you what the headline is. I'm not lying to you with these sunglasses. Rock and Roll Czar. That's the article in the Financial Times, December 5th and 6th. U2's manager right there. I'm not reading the article. It does not flow. It's too long. But those of you in this hip-hoppreneur music industry army that we are coordinating, please get this article. Rock and Roll Czar. Okay? And we can build on it. SetBoogie@gmail.com is where you can email me whatever. All your bad music that you want me to play, as well as any comments about the show. I take it to heart. Okay, I have impressed Rod Guignard enough with my knowledge of Henry Grimes, the great jazz bassist. Let me read this article about Tiger Woods, and then MySpace, and then I'm going to get out of here. SetBoogie@gmail, CEDBOOGIE@gmail. This is an article, again, from the Peach Paper, the Financial Times. Tiger Woods an asset even with transgressions.
Watchman, Cedric Muhammad on the Black Coffee Channel.